Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. And the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 4, our mini-series on medical education. I'm Dr. Molly Hoybein, joined by my co-host, Dr. Ira Kurzhnevskaya, and our returning co-host, Dr. Charlotte Chaiklin. On today's episode, we'll discuss how to teach learners to ask and answer clinical questions at the bedside with Dr. Nick Maldonado, covering all things evidence-based medicine. Before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on the show?
You got it, Molly. We are the internal medicine podcast for all things medical education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of medical educators. Charlotte, do you want to introduce our amazing guest tonight?
Absolutely. We have an amazing conversation with our guest, Dr. Nick Maldonado, tonight as we cover how to teach learners evidence-based clinical practice principles, specifically asking questions and acquiring knowledge at the bedside. Dr. Maldonado is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Florida and the associate program director for the University of Florida Emergency Medicine Residency Program. He received the American College of Emergency Physicians National Emergency Medicine Junior Faculty Teaching Award and has a specific passion for evidence-based medicine, which we will share with you now.
And we're excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance of Academic Internal Medicine. So a reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. So without further ado,
let's get to it. Hi, Dr. Maldonado. Thank you so much for joining us and coming on the show today. Are you okay if we call you Nick for this recording?
Yeah, absolutely. You can call me Nick.
Great. Well, just to get started off so we can get to know you a little better, could you give us a one-liner to describe yourself and maybe include something from outside of medicine?
Sure. I'm a native New Yorker, a former jazz guitar player turned academic emergency physician, an associate program director for an incredible emergency medicine training program down south. I spent the last 8 years in graduate medical education. And when I'm not educating residents and taking care of patients, I have two beautiful children, an 8-year-old and a 9-year-old.
Could you give us maybe or tell us about some meaningful advice or feedback that you received during your career or training?
Yeah, so I mean, I can break that down into a couple of different stages. And so, you know, when I was a medical student, one of my favorite books to read was something called William Osler, Life in Medicine. And I always loved William Osler aphorisms. And so I got a lot of my kind of early advice from that book. And one of the aphorisms he had that I really liked was the practice of medicine is an art, not a trade. A calling, not a business, a calling in which your heart will be exercised equally with your head. And I absolutely love that. And I think, you know, it even stands true now as medicine just gets bigger. It's one of those things I think always brings me back to this being a calling. And so I love that aphorism. And then when I was in residency, I heard something really important from one of my faculty members. Now, being an academic emergency physician, she told me, always remember academic medicine's a marathon, not a race. Mm. And I've always kind of took that to heart, this is sort of a slow build over your career. And I love that word of advice.
I love that, Nick. And I also love that for a moment, I was like, did Nick go to Hopkins? Because the Osler powerhouse quotes, I was like, oh, this feels like a very Baltimore comment. But those are beautiful. And I think really kind of nicely capture the essence of each of those stages of your career and your life. As a jazz musician or say jazz musician at heart, do you have a favorite kind of media book, movie, show, album, song that you've listened to recently that you want to share with the audience?
Music-wise, I'd say my favorite was Chick Corea. He's a jazz pianist, and I absolutely love that. When I do reading, I don't tend to read things regarding music currently, but the most recent thing I've been reading actually is a great book by Arthur C. Brooks. It's called From Strength to Strength. And I'd highly recommend that. It's a phenomenal book. What that's about is basically how to find meaning and purpose in the second half of your career, the second half of life. And he has a lot of really amazing insights. And that was recommended to me by one of my colleagues, a really dear friend. And I absolutely love the book. So I would certainly recommend that to anybody.
Okay, sweet. So should we jump into a case?
Yeah, let's do it.
This is a case from Cashlack Memorial Hospital. Sarah is an early career attending, working on the inpatient teaching team. After admitting a patient with acute hypoxemic respiratory failure in the setting of community-acquired pneumonia, one of the residents on the team asks if the patient needs steroids. While Sarah knows herself the answer to this question, she wants to teach that resident physician how to answer this question independently using the latest evidence. And maybe, Nick, we can start with the basics here. What is evidence-based medicine or evidence-based practice in healthcare? And why is it important to teach this explicitly as a skill?
Yeah, so that's a really big question. So when I think about evidence-based medicine, you think about three components. One, there needs to be clinical skills. So there's clinical skills that's there, and that's what you learn in medical school. That's making the diagnosis. That's having the skills to interpret EKGs, radiology, et cetera. The second thing is being able to critically appraise literature. And so having the knowledge to be able to appraise the literature. And then the third is how to know how to apply that to patients, but really also taking into account the patient's preferences, values, and other things like cost analysis. And so evidence-based medicine, I think, is a term that, you know, ties all of those things together. Your clinical skills, your knowledge of your ability to appraise the literature, and then how to talk to patients and make a shared decision. And I think when people think about evidence-based medicine, they think about critical appraisal. But, you know, critical appraisal is one piece of what evidence-based medicine is, you know? And evidence-based clinical practice is sort of that practice of utilizing your skills plus the literature and best available evidence to apply to patient care and have great decisions. So, you know, it's quite a broad category, but it's history's phenomenon. I mean, there's a really great paper in BMJ. It's called Evidence-Based Medicine and Oral History, and I'd really recommend that. I can reference it for you folks to include in the show notes, but it's a really great read, and it actually has videos associated with it, so I'd highly recommend that to anybody who's a student or interested in that.
Thanks, Nick. I really appreciate how you broke down those components. And I think we're going to talk, you know, a lot about the second one, the critically appraising the literature. But I actually feel like the third component is a little bit like the underdog slash like the one that doesn't get a lot of attention. Maybe it's like the third cousin. I feel like there's so much out there that's not shared when we talk about patients, you know, looking at the literature with us. Like in clinic, I don't sit there and always like translate number needed to treat to a patient. And I don't think I do that as well. It's definitely a growth edge. So I feel like there's like room for, you know, medical education, health professions education to think about how do we apply what we're, you know, learning from the literature to the patient conversation and do it in like a patient, you know, centered and understandable way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the challenging things when people start doing this or approaching it is that it can be a bit overwhelming. And so I think we could talk later part of the case of how you might break it up into sort of segments. And so, you know, we'll talk a little bit about how you can, like what the sequence of events might be, and perhaps on a service, how you might break down each component so that it's not all in one shot, but you can kind of go sequentially through some of the steps to applying this to patient care. And we'll go through each one of those.
Okay. And I actually have heard about these steps because you taught them to me a few weeks ago, but could you tell our listeners about framing kind of evidence-based medicine application at the bedside around the five A's?
Yeah, so absolutely. And so I think, you know, this comes from the JAMA User's Guide to the Medical Literature, and it's a really great framework, I think, in how to approach, you know, what we're seeing clinically and then how to act on it as a patient. And so one of the concepts in EBM is what's called the five A's. So the first is ask, like how to ask a great relevant question. And we'll talk a little bit about the different types of questions, but questions, you know, can come from us or they can come from our patients. So asking a question, I think, is the first step. The second thing is then acquiring it. So like, how do you find the answer to the clinical question that you're asking in an efficient way? And that's something that we can also share and teach to our learners. And we can do that quite quickly at the bedside. And I'll go into a little bit of that. And then the third is appraise. And, you know, I think appraisal, when we think appraisal, we think about journal club, you know, and it's really tough to do an immediate appraisal at the bedside. You're not going to do a whole journal club for each patient. But I think one of the important things to note is that there are a lot of pre-appraised resources that are out there where someone's already done the appraisal. And I think even sharing that with our learners is something that's really important. So then after appraise is applying, so how would I apply this to a specific patient encounter or my next patient encounter? In what clinical situation might I apply this particular paper to? You know, everybody's unique and different. And so, right, in this particular example, you used a case of community-acquired pneumonia, right? And so is it bacterial? Is it viral? Is it fungal? You know, does this patient have diabetes? You mentioned severe. So there's outpatient versus hospitalized versus severe patients. And so really when you're, you know, educating your learners in appraisal, you also want to teach them how to apply or what specific patient population you want to apply that specific article to. And then the last one is acting on it. And then acting on it really incorporates the patient. It's like, you know, these are my clinical skills. This is the diagnosis that I made. And then here are the treatment options. And, you know, based on the treatment options that I've outlined to you, let's hear about your values. Let's weigh risks and benefits. And let's see what might be best for you. And, you know, sometimes there are things that are standard of care. And I'll have conversations with patients of, you know, this is something that's standard. This is standardly what we do, or this is guideline recommended. But there's also something that's available to you. And this is what I want to discuss with you today. That's sort of what those extra discussions are. I don't have that conversation with all my patients when it's standard. You know, it's I'll kind of lay out, this is my recommendation. But let's say there are a couple of different alternative treatment options or something new that's out there. That's where the ACT and really having that conversation and generating patient values really comes in.
Great. Well, I like having a framework because that does make it easier to keep track of when we're trying to put this into practice with our learners. So we've got those five A's, the ask, acquire, appraise, apply, and act. Maybe we can break down the ask a little bit more and think about what types of clinical questions learners may bring up on a shift during rounds in the clinic. How do you kind of break down types of questions and thinking about how those questions may fall into different categories?
Yeah, so the way I think about these questions is really as an educator trying to identify what resource I'm going to point myself or my learners to. I think one of the biggest challenges I had when I was a resident was trying to find the information that I needed to gather. You know, like, where do I look for this information? And us as educators can be guides in sort of helping to navigate that based on the types of questions that they're asking. And so if you look, there's two main big categories of questions. There's background questions and there's foreground questions. Background questions seek to answer a question of general knowledge. These are your like who, what, where, when types of questions. And so if a learner asks, for example, you know, what is acute coronary syndrome? You're not going to start delving into the big details behind Brilinta trials on acute coronary syndrome, right? They still need the foundation of what acute coronary syndrome is. And so in a situation like that, you might want to refer your learner to more of a foundational resource to seek that information. That would be sort of like a evidence-based textbook like UpToDate or DynaMed, or a textbook like Harrison's, or a review article, narrative review article. You're not going to be guiding them to answering a focused clinical question because they don't have that foundation yet, you know? The other type of question is a foreground question. And so a foreground question is something that's very specific and focused, and it's usually geared towards something regarding diagnosis, therapy, harm, prognosis, you know. So in this patient who's presenting to the hospital with severe community-acquired pneumonia, you know, does steroids improve this patient's mortality? Very, very focused question that comes with a lot of previous foundation. Now, if you're going to have that foreground question, there's specific places you can look to efficiently to try to find that answer compared to a textbook or compared to, you know, an evidence-based text. You'd really be guiding your learner to a higher level of evidence or something more recent.
And before you jump into that, Nick, and tell us exactly where to acquire that to hit on the second A, I guess just I'm hearing a lot of like framing, and we love, as Molly said, we love frameworks, we love framing breakdown of questions. How do you help Sarah, you know, frame this question? I mean, you're doing some of it as you're kind of explaining that it's a, you know, a foreground question, but is there any other kind of a way that you approach it that might be a four-letter mnemonic that we could use?
Yeah, Eric, thanks for, thank you for that. So I think we've all heard of the PICO format, the P-I-C-O format, in the setting of journal club. But I'll often frame this when questions come up from patients or also when my residents will ask a random question, because I also think that it not only helps with going through a journal club article, but it also helps with crafting a question and then querying it. And so I'll talk a little bit about that later. So it's very important, I think, to kind of frame it for our learners, and it helps them, helps guide them in really asking a very focused question. And so the P in the PICO or PICO framework is your patient population. And the patient population, I think it's really important also to be very specific. And so, you know, as I mentioned, if in this particular example, you know, this is a patient who's hospitalized with severe pneumonia, right? This isn't like an outpatient with pneumonia. So really being very specific about your patient population will help your learner sort of understand when they're looking at the literature, whether or not it's what they're trying to actually apply, the patient group they're trying to apply this to. The second is I, which is intervention. So what's the intervention that you're, you know, looking at, or what's the main treatment that you're wanting to prescribe that you have a question about? So here, for example, the intervention would be steroids. The C, you know, being control, and so, or the comparator. Sometimes the comparator is a control, sometimes it's standard of care, but, you know, what am I comparing this to? And then the O standing for outcome. And so really, when I go over this with my resident learners also, I try to help them come up with what they think are important outcomes. What are things that I would care about in this particular situation? You know, would I want to give steroids to improve their oxygen saturation from 90 to 94%? Is that something I care about if that was a positive study? Or do I really care about something more patient-centered, you know, like risk of requiring intubation, length of hospital, length of stay, mortality? So really trying to ask them and have them come up with the information of, you know, what are the outcomes that I find to be important? And that's also going to help them frame what they're looking for when they try to find the answer to their question. So, you know, the questions come up always on shifts. I know my learners really, I might annoy them with this, but I'll say, okay, let's frame that into a clinical question. So what's your PICO? And then I'll have them write it out. And again, instead of giving them the answer, I'll say, okay, now let's take a look and find the answer for me. Find an article or a relevant article that you think is the best available evidence. And that's how I'll teach them how to be independent learners.
And let's say, moving kind of into that, you have a learner that has their question and now they don't really know where to begin, because I think that's a common scenario for most learners and faculty too sometimes. What resources do you use, or would you recommend teachers use to kind of encourage learners to go into the acquired phase and get an answer to their question?
So that's a really great question. And again, I think step one is this a background question or a foreground question? You know, and you have a, you know, in this particular case, you have a senior resident, right? But sometimes our residents think they know a lot more about a situation than they actually do. And that's where we as educators can sort of ask some of the background questions to see if they have a foundational knowledge before asking a specific question. You know, sometimes our learners aren't prepared to ask a very focused question, and your teaching point for that day might be the foundations, right? So if I, you know, saw this particular case, I might ask the learner first just to get a quick needs assessment. You know, does this learner have a good solid foundation? You know, you mentioned community acquired pneumonia. How do we classify pneumonias? You know, just give me some examples of how we might classify pneumonia, you know. How might treatment differ for community acquired pneumonia compared to other types of pneumonias? Like, how do those differ? You know, what other treatment options have you heard? You mentioned steroids, but how else do we treat this? You know, you mentioned this patient had severe pneumonia. So community-acquired pneumonia has a spectrum of illness. So, you know, how might we risk stratify patients based on level of severity? And the reason why I'm bringing this up as being extremely important is because if they just go out and, you know, ask a question if they query the literature, they're going to get thousands of hits and they're not going to be able to kind of focus or even put this question into context. So this is a very, very specific question. And so you want to make sure that your learner has that foundation before they're even going to be ready to jump into trying to find the answer to that. So I just wanted to bring that point up that, you know, one of the things that I started doing as an educator is I assume less that my learners kind of know. And I just ask them kind of open-ended questions and kind of see where they're at. And that's a great way to evaluate them. But it's also a great way to say, like, are they ready for kind of advanced questions? Or do I need to print out a review article for them or tell them, like, hey, this would be a great read for tonight for Harrison's to look into what community-acquired pneumonia is. And then tomorrow we'll talk about, you know, how to include other therapies like steroids into your management strategy. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's something that I often will do.
And quick shout out, Nick, I will say that I just listened to a webinar, which I don't often enjoy, but today I did, about asking people questions, like exactly as you mentioned, like getting learners on board for actually cold calling questions and making that acceptable, especially on rounds. And so I just wanted to like extra emphasize that you can't really assume that people know certain things. And you could say something like, you know, what do we think is the way to diagnose pneumonia? And then like look at everybody, pause, and then say, Molly and Charlotte, would you guys like to take a stab, you know, or something like that, like give that question, that pause and that name. I think mm-hmm. that's like that one of the big takeaways from this webinar. And I just wanted to like extra highlight it because I think your point about figuring out the question and where to go to answer the question relies on a certain foundational knowledge that you just don't know if people have unless you ask them.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Monologue over.
That was great. That was great. And Charlotte, getting to the second part of your question now. Okay, so let's assume that this is an amazing learner. She knows everything about every question I asked her about community acquired. She's ready. You know, she's ready to go over, you know, steroids for severe community acquired pneumonia. So now you have, you know, this large database of information called the internet. You know, and you know, it's overwhelming, I think, to learners that there's just so much access to things that if you were to just type in pneumonia and steroids into PubMed, you'll probably get thousands, if not tens of thousands of hits, right? And now you're going to ask your learner to go home and sift through those and find the correct article to answer that question. That becomes overwhelming. And I remember as a resident, that was a huge source of frustration, was like, where do I find the information that I am supposed to gather, you know? And so one of the things that I learned during this process of doing a little bit deeper dive in evidence-based medicine is there's something called this 5 or 6 S pyramid model. And so if you want, I can dive a little bit into that and you know, how to utilize that to efficiently answer clinical questions if you guys are ready for that.
Sure. And just for the listeners to know, we will have this in the show notes so you can reference that if you're more of a visual learner.
And I do want to clarify also for listeners, you heard correctly, there are 5 A's and there are 5 S's. So those are two. There is a little bit of parallel there. So just like you did not have a, you know, hallucination, but go on, Nick.
So basically this concept, right, is, you know, we ask a learner to find evidence to prove to us, you know, what, you know, whether or not they want to prescribe a treatment to a resident or that's something that they would answer their question. And, you know, I'll pose, a learner who's not well-versed in this goes on to PubMed and just types in steroids and pneumonia, and they find a really great case report, you know, of a patient who benefited from steroids, you know. And, you know, we think about that, and we're like, wow, there's thousands of articles. And, you know, when we think about the hierarchy of evidence for studies, you know, that's sort of the lower bar for studies and whether we want to make decisions for a large group of patients. So I think we're all familiar with the hierarchy of evidence when it comes to original studies, with sort of these, you know, synopses, these meta-analyses, systematic reviews being at the top, you know, randomized controlled trials, observational studies, you know, case series, case reports, et cetera. But what the 5S, you know, pyramid model talks about is that when it comes to assessing or looking for the answer or searching for the best available evidence, there's also a hierarchy for that as well, you know, and at the top of that hierarchy is what they call systems, you know, so systems. And, you know, what's systems? So a lot of us work in large healthcare institutions, right? And we have electronic health records, and there are things that are embedded within the electronic health record that incorporate systematic reviews, guidelines, expert opinion to design things that are really good for patient care, right? So we might talk about, let's say, a diabetic ketoacidosis order sets, right? You know, that's sort of like a systems approach to answering a question. And so if the question was, how do you treat, or with like, how do you treat diabetic ketoacidosis? The answer is in the system, you know? And so going to the peak, going to the top first, right? Now, let's say, for example, the answer is not at the systems level. So then you would move down to the next level, which essentially would be a summaries. So summaries of the summation of the literature. And what those summaries might include would be things like guidelines. And so guidelines, again, are summaries of systematic reviews. They're summaries of original articles. And they're done by expert panels that have done a lot of research to query thousands of articles to then put into something that they could answer very focused clinical questions. And so guidelines would sort of be the next thing. And so what I do often for my residents when a clinical question comes up is the first thing I ask them to do, if there's not something that's already been embedded or a clinical pathway at our institution, I'll say, is there a guideline for that? You know, so I'll have them search for guidelines. And, you know, in the past, National Guideline Clearinghouse was one of my favorite resources that lost funding around, I think it was during the Trump administration lost funding and now doesn't exist. But then there's Guideline Central. And then for each organization, that's where us as educators can sort of guide them, right? So, okay, this question is about the heart. You know, like there are AHA guidelines. There might be an AHA guideline for this. Or this question is about infectious disease. You know, let's query the IDSA literature. You know, this question is, you know, about GI. Let's look at the American College of Gastroenterology. And so oftentimes when I have these conversations about guidelines with residents, I'll either show them these search engines for guidelines or speak to them about different organizations that have great guidelines that might answer that question. So the next step after that is I would really look for a synopsis. So that's the next S. So the top would be systems, summaries, then the next one under that would be synopses. And so if, let's say, there was a systematic review, but someone had already read that systematic review and wrote a commentary on how to apply that to patient care, that is a synopsis of a systematic review, right? Instead of reading a 70-page article that's a full-on systematic review, which you're not going to be able to do at the bedside, reading someone's really thorough, edit, you know, peer-reviewed one-page report and how to apply this to patient care, an individual journal club essentially is sort of the next area that I would look at. It's quite efficient, and you know there are different types of resources for that. You know, there's Journal Watch, for example, is a great example of synopses. One of my favorite resources is American College of Physicians Journal Club, so ACP Journal Club. That's another great area that has synopses of systematic reviews. And in emergency medicine, we have ASEP systematic review snapshots. So lots of different organizations have their own, you know, versions of what these synopses are of these large scale meta-analyses, systematic reviews.
And do you then teach the five S's before you even get to answering the question with learners? I actually had a learner give me feedback. They wanted more primary literature taught to them, like randomized controlled trials, and less guidelines. But I felt so empowered after learning from you about the five S's that I actually messaged them the five S pyramid. I said, just so you're aware, this is a higher level of evidence. How kind of do you apply the five S's to answering questions with a learner?
So again, I mean, if I have a clinical question, they want to answer, you know, now, right? Like we want to try to find a quick answer, or, you know, you're on bedside rounds and we want to know, what are we going to do with this patient at the moment? You know, that's when I use this specific, you know, technique, right? So you'll look for, do we have a system? Is there a summary that's available, like a guideline? Are there synopses? Let's say that there's no synopses there. I'll move down the pyramid and go to a synthesis and actually look at a meta-analysis or systematic review. And then if that's not available, that's when I'll get to the original studies, you know? I'll get to the original studies there. One of the other ways that I apply this to efficiently find an answer is I use what's called a federated search. So I'm not sure if you've heard of federated searches, but federated searches are essentially like search engines of search engines. And so a couple of federated searches that I love, one is Trip Database. And so if you go onto the TRIP database, that is a great resource. What I really love about it is that they actually have a tab that has PICO. And so you put your actual PICO question in there. And then not only that, but when it queries the literature, it has a bar on the left that breaks it down into guidelines, summaries, synopses, syntheses, individual articles. And so then you can kind of choose what your level of evidence that you want to read is. And I think that's an amazing way of showing learners like how these different types of things interrelate. Other ones that I really like, so there's SumSearch too, there's Access. Access is from McMaster University. I love Access. Epistemonikos. So these are all federated searches. I'd say my two go-tos are the TRIP database and Access. And as an educator, I would just familiarize yourselves with a few ones that you really, really like to use, because I think that'll kind of help show the value to your learner and how you incorporate that into your practice. I have a few that I use, and when I'm teaching this, I'll kind of open those up and go through them with learners and just show them why I use those specific resources that I do.
And Nick, quick like location check, is that is TRIP database something that is like kind of like up to date where you need access to it? Or is it something where anybody, any educator, regardless of profession and institution, can access it?
Anybody can access it. So, yeah, if you just Google TRIP database, you can go on to their website. I don't know if there's any specific features. Certain search engines, there might be like a pro option. I don't know if they specifically have one, but I know anybody can access TRIP database to utilize. You know, Charlotte, getting to your question earlier. So you mentioned your students want to go over original studies or, actual studies. So that brings up a great point, too, of like, how much can I include in one session at the bedside? And so for me as an emergency physician, of the five A's, I focus on the first two A's. Clinically, right? Like I have a fast-paced environment. So I'm really helping my residents craft a good clinical question. So after I see a case, I might say, hey, choose one or two cases today, and I want you to come up with a clinical question, and I want you to give me a foreground question that's in a PICO framework. And, that's your task, for today. And then let's say once that's over, let's query the literature, and I want you to find tonight the best available evidence, and I'm going to compete with you. If I could match that or have something better, and then tomorrow when I'm on shift with you, we'll share notes. That's how I apply that. And again, it's really, I'm in a busy environment. I can't go through absolutely everything, but that's how I would apply it literally in like 5 minutes. And sometimes the discussion is, these are the types of resources that are available. These are my favorite ones, but I think you should focus from the top of the pyramid. Let's look at something that the healthcare system has. Do we have a clinical guideline pathway in our institution? All right, if not, are there guidelines? Let's talk about certain types of guidelines. If not there, here's some synopsis. That's kind of how I do this like 5 minute spiel when I'm working clinically in a fast-paced environment. Now, let's say we get to the point where they want to actually go through the article. Mm-hmm. Now this is like you as an educator kind of framing, where things are performed, right? So like that's a great journal club, right? That's where the context of journal club is. That's the critical appraisal piece, is you've found articles and now you're going to review them. That's kind of where that third A, your appraisal is taught, is like in a journal club setting. Sometimes that could be a formal setting, like if you have a departmental journal club, but also, if you're on in service and, maybe that's a small group of like, you and two other students and, maybe part of your teaching in the morning was everybody find a clinical question and let's find an article. And then the afternoon is let's do a quick journal club, but now we'll do a deeper dive into the article and talk a little bit more about EBM principles, it doesn't have to be in the same moment. It can be scattered throughout the day. It could be scattered throughout the week. So that's how I would recommend incorporating that into, a longitudinal practice on a, if you're on service, for example.
I love that. That feels very doable in the moment. And I think lowers the bar for educators who may not feel as confident in this space. So very approachable. We're preparing for an artificial intelligence and how it's going to impact medicine down the line. Do you think this is going to change how we look at evidence-based medicine? I mean, with things like open evidence that you can just type in sort of a casual question and it will give you some resources.
That's a really, really great point and a really great topic, but what I think is even more important for us to be able to do, which you can use some of these principles with, is really having your learners question where the information is coming from. And so I think that's going to be our value as educators, is having them be free thinkers and being curious about, like, well, where did this actually come from? And the reason why I bring that up is because, let's say, for example, you know, the top of your evidence pyramid when you're making a decision is a guideline. And the guideline answers your question. You don't have to stop there with your learner. You could say, well, let's see why they made these recommendations. Like, where did that actually come from? And then you can go to the primary source and actually go to the primary studies to kind of decide, oh, these were the studies that guided it, you know? It also kind of brings up a point of, sometimes guidelines aren't always up to date. Sometimes the most recent guideline is 2018. That might not be the best available evidence. You know, back in 2018, there might have been tons of trials that came out since then. And again, this example of steroids is a perfect example, right? If you look at, you know, American Thoracic Society or IDSA guidelines, when those were compared to when Cape Cod came out and when some other, you know, more recent meta-analyses came out, these came out much later. So those also bring up great points about being lifelong learners and why these are important principles and why these are skills to have to be instilled, as opposed to me just telling you what the most recent RCT was and giving you the answer. Is giving you the skill to, you know, question, where is this coming from? How do I get to it? You know, how do I compare this to my to what might otherwise be lower level of evidence, but it's a newer trial. But, you know, the guideline was based on 3 observational studies, and now this is a multi-center randomized control trial. Those are amazing teaching points to have with learners that I think we take for granted that we should have more.
I love that, Nick, because I also think there's a component of, like, the AI clarification, like what happens when it hallucinates, like what happens when a guideline comes up that you're like, ooh, that's not a real guideline, or like that guideline's from like 2018. It's like, it takes that curiosity that you're talking about that says, like, wait, I need to, like, check this AI program, computer, whatever it is, to just make sure that there's not, like, something that isn't in existence or a hallucination behind it.
Yeah, I think the troubleshooting skills, you know, like that, you know, that's going to be huge in kind of trying to help understand what goes into it. How much can you trust it? You know, and a lot of EBM principles are about that. You know, can you trust the article that you're reading? How much can you trust the results that's something valid that I could apply to patient care, you know?
Well, I feel like we've gone through 3/5 of the A's, like, very kind of confidently and assuredly. And I just wonder if there was more around the apply A that you wanted to highlight, or should we move on to how we do those shared values and shared decision making with the patient?
You know, apply refers to, in what clinical circumstances might I apply this to my current or next patient encounter based on the evidence that's in front of me, you know? So, like, in what clinical situation would I prescribe the intervention to a patient? Like, and also, in what clinical situation would I not prescribe this intervention to a patient? So getting your learners to think critically about taking the summation of a patient's clinical condition and their unique aspects. Great examples being, like, comorbidities, you know, and allergies, like if a patient's allergic to something, right? Those are, like, simple, right? If a patient's allergic to X, you're not going to be using it. But that's just a really, really simple example of, like, when you would and would not apply something, you know? It's also a great teaching opportunity with respect to embracing variability. One of the things I didn't mention earlier when we talked about kind of asking open-ended questions to, you know, our learners. So, you know, if this learner asked me a question about using steroids in community-acquired pneumonia, one of my first steps is I ask an open-ended question about their experiences. And so, like, that's a great point. You know, tell me a little bit about your experience with using steroids or when you've seen it. And so now they're kind of telling you about, oh, I had a case, like, last week with so-and-so, but then, like, this person, like, didn't do it. But then, like, last week, like, someone used it, but they used, like, a different type of medication. You know, it's, like, so variable, you know? And so I think the application piece ties in with that really, really well, is that, like, what might apply to one particular patient in one situation might not apply to another patient encounter, and here's why. You know, I think that's really important, and that's the really important piece of the evidence-based medicine cycle is, you know, when would I apply this? What situations might I not? And then also making it normal for our learners to embrace variability. You're going to have attendings who do different things, and there's different interpretations of literature, different patient applications, and here's why. That's the art of medicine, right? That's the art of medicine. So you mentioned the last one. So like, what does the act phase mean? So acting refers now to having an open conversation with your patient or family regarding what intervention or interventions are available to them. I'm not saying to like be exhaustive, right? Like I don't do this every single, like I'm with Tylenol, hey, there's Tylenol available to you, you know? But really when there's something that's extra that deviates, I think, from your standard, or there's a new therapy that you really want to discuss with them. So I'll often frame my conversations and frame this with my learners that, you know, I'll state to a patient, you know, it's current standard of care for this condition or current guidelines recommend that we treat you with blank and admit you to the hospital. But that's what I'm going to recommend now. But with your specific situation, you might also be a candidate for some additional therapies that may be beneficial, that have some potentials, and there might be some cost associated with this, but it hasn't gotten to the point where we're always using it. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, you know? And that's how I might frame sort of a conversation or acting on the evidence that I might have gained from a specific article and then utilizing it in my patient care and how I frame kind of that answer.
Amazing. Well, that was very helpful to talk through the five A's. And I think your recommendation of kind of breaking it down and maybe only focusing on the first two in a bedside clinical encounter is a great first step for educators. Do you have any other sort of low-hanging fruit or tips for educators to just kind of get started with this or ways to kind of jump into this at the bedside?
I think the main takeaway that I have is don't overcomplicate things. Most of your learners won't even be at the point where they know how to craft good questions and where to find answers to those questions, you know? And so that alone is a great starting point for incorporating at least some evidence-based medicine at the bedside. And that alone is also highly valuable to your learners. And so speaking of about assumptions, I wouldn't assume that even those things are skills that have been mastered already. I think if people start there and they're interested, there's some great resources that I could recommend. Just kind of getting a little bit back to how I got interested in this. Back in 2016, I had the opportunity to go to McMaster University and study with Dr. Gordon Guy. He had an evidence-based clinical practice workshop, and it was for educators. And one of the really fun things that we did there was that we had to take really complex EBM principles and distill it down to 5-minute snippets. You know, and so I had JAMA User's Guide to the Medical Literature. I would open up a chapter and I'd be like, now I have to make a quick 5-minute spiel chalk talk, you know? And so one thing I might recommend is if you're a student of this or if this is something that's really interesting to you and you want to share more things, you can get these tons of little pearls to be able to share with your students. And if you guys ever have me back on, I can go over some of those also because I have a lot of little a little EBM talks that I'll do at the bedside with my learners. This is one of them, but many others. And again, if it's something that your listeners have of interest, I have a lot of resources that I can share with them.
That's so awesome, Nick. Maybe we can kind of summarize and going back to our case for Sarah. Let's say you are Sarah on the service. The resident asks you this question about steroids and acute hypoxemic respiratory failure for community-acquired pneumonia. What would be your approach? Like in that moment, how would you kind of approach that question?
Yeah. So again, the first thing I would do, so number one, like even before getting into the EBM, you know, 5 A's, the first thing I do with her is I'd say, so that's a really interesting question. Tell me a little bit more about your experience with steroids. And, you know, we talked about that earlier, but I might kind of garner, you know, some interest. And then the second thing is then I would probably start assessing background knowledge first, you know, to see if she's ready to answer that question. And so that's when I'd ask some of those questions regarding specifics for, you know, community-acquired pneumonia. So now we're kind of delving into the first part of that, which is, let's say we have this assumption and now we're at the ask phase. I'd say that's a really great question. Let's try to craft a really specific clinical question for this patient. First, I want to ask you, have you ever heard of the PICO framework? You know, and let's say there's a no answer, then you could have a great conversation about that and why that's important and how you can frame questions that way. And that's your teaching point. Let's say she has, then okay, great. Let's craft a clinical question using the PICO format. So I want you to craft it. Let's do this together. And I would even look it over and see if it's very specific, right? I think even with that, students can do that at variable different levels, right? As I mentioned earlier, there's different types of pneumonias. There's different practice settings. There's different types of steroids. You know, there's different outcomes. And so you could even take the time to even go through that and say, you know, I noticed that you use this as an outcome. Like, tell me, are there any other important outcomes that you might be interested in? Or, you know, you mentioned community acquired pneumonia. Would this change our question if we were to ask this about like COVID pneumonia? You know, is that different? So then you can kind of ask those types of questions. And then from there, then I would say, okay, next step, let's look for the best available evidence to ask this specific focused clinical question that you have. Where would you go or what would you look for if you were to answer this question? Again, I'm asking lots of questions to see where this learner's at. And if I hear like, I'm going to go to PubMed and I'm going to type this in, I'm like, great, we have a lot of teaching we can do, you know? and then I'll maybe have them do that. So like, go ahead, type that in, you know? And then yeah. They type it in, like, how many queries did you get? So how could we make that a little bit different? And then I might ask more questions, like, have there people who have done this work before? What does it mean when people get together and, you know, go over studies? What you look for? And then they might say, oh, guideline. I'm like, okay, great. So what resources have you ever seen to look for guidelines? Like, where do you look for those? I have no idea. Okay, well, that's teaching. Let me show you where I look when I look for guidelines. Here's a great resource. You know, let me show you where I look specifically for infectious disease guidelines. You know, this also spans critical care. So I didn't know if you knew this, but there's a Society for Critical Care guideline for pneumonia and steroids. So let's take a look at that, you know? So that brings up a lot of really great points. And again, we've been talking about this now. I think like I just had a 5-minute spiel. And we talked about a lot of things that you could talk about, and we didn't even delve into nitty-gritty details about, you know, study designs and surrogate outcomes and founders. This is all still evidence-based medicine, and this is basics that you want them to master.
Well, I also feel like we talked about like learners getting a sense of what they know. I mean, I think there's also a component for us, you know, we are like, it's kind of like assessing as educators or as faculty, like, where are we in that, you know, ask the first A step of our approach to evidence-based medicine, evidence-based practice, and kind of critical appraisal, especially of literature that comes through our proverbial desk, or in Charlotte's mm-hmm. case, like, you know, people wanting more, which don't worry, Charlotte, not just you, all of us get asked that question. Yes. Like, Ira, why didn't you take us through the latest study on buprenorphine? And I'm like, that's your job. You know, like, you're going to do that. And I guess just to, you know, wrap up kind of, Nick, in terms of the, you know, that 5-minute spiel was amazing. And I wonder for some of us who need kind of a gentle on-ramp mm-hmm. to like the practice of, you know, the 5 A's and then ultimately incorporating the 5 S pyramid, is there a place that you would recommend like noobs to EBM that they start at a certain place? Like, would it be the ask, like, get your question down, or would it yeah. be somewhere else?
No, absolutely. Because I think that would be important for us to master also. And I think that also gets us as educators in the habit of asking our learners questions, because I think that, you know, once I've shifted that frame, and, you know, we do that a lot with even feedback, right? Like advocacy and inquiry and asking questions of our learners, those are all important concepts. And so one of the biggest things that instills is the curiosity. You're helping to instill curiosity in your learners, and you really want to train them how to do that. So I think that would be a great first step in getting really familiar with PICO. Start there. And second step, you know, get really well versed in different resources on that model, that pyramid model. So like, if you were yourself to look for things as a clinician, as a seasoned clinician, mm-hmm. where would you go? What do you like? You know, what things, what resources do you like and why? And if you were to tell a learner, this is why I like this resource over another, this is why. I think it's really good to kind of know what's available, what's out there in your own area of practice. I know it's different for internal medicine than it is for emergency medicine. So, you know, when I give this talk to emergency medicine educators, I have a bunch of EM resources, you know, mm-hmm. You could easily extrapolate that to whatever field of study that you're in, whatever specialty you're in.
Amazing. Well, we covered so much. This has been fantastic. Anything that you think we missed that we need to cover? And if not, do you have any take-home points that you want to share with our listeners?
No, I mean, unless you have any further questions, I think we talked a lot about kind of what I think a great focus would be. And I think one of the biggest things I would recommend too is, this is important for us to instill into our learners. What we want is we want our learners to be free, independent thinkers. We want them to be thoughtful consumers of the medical literature. And we want them to be able to find the best available evidence and have great communication with our patients to allow them to make the best decisions for their patient care. That's what this, to me, is really all about. And us, you know, participating in that journey, I think, is really important. So some of my take homes, I'd say, so evidence-based medicine is a core competency for physicians, right? So something we should regularly be instilling in our learners and takes deliberate practice. I shared one of many topics within EBM that can be readily taught at the bedside. Another key point, the 5 A's is easy to remember. It's a nice framework when applying evidence to patients. So remember, ask, acquire, appraise, apply, and act. You know, as I said earlier, don't overcomplicate things. Most of your learners won't even be at the point where they know how to craft good questions and where to find answers to those questions. So that alone is a great starting point when you want to incorporate, you know, even the basics of EBM principles into the bedside rounds. So I think that's super important. For all the educators out there, you're unique and you have your own teaching styles. So consider reflecting on what we talked about today and how you might incorporate it based on your own unique teaching style, right? I showed you how I might do it, but, you know, reflect on this and how you might incorporate it into your own style, right? Sharing knowledge and clinical pearls is important to what we do, but imparting onto your students practical and readily applicable skills is greater than spewing minute facts that they'll probably not remember anyways. So keep that in mind. And the last thing, don't burden yourself as a medical educator and don't burden yourself to feel that you need to teach your learners everything about medicine. That's impossible. View your role as a guide. And if you inspired your learners to want to learn more, then you did your job. So those are my big take homes.
Beautiful.
I love them.
I feel like we should call that like the Maldonado Manifesto or something like that. It was like in the speech rhetoric too. It's very,
I know. Somebody's going to come back in 20 years and be like, my favorite piece of advice was from Dr. Maldonado.
Yes. Yes. This day and on the Curbsiders Teach episode.
Fantastic. Well, anything that you're working on or that you've recently published or that you want to plug to share with the audience, something that you're excited about in your professional or personal life that you'd like to plug?
No, I just published two articles. One was in JSEP Open. It's a study that was done. So one of my other areas of interest is difficult airway management and difficult airway response teams. And so in the Journal of American College of Emergency Physicians Open, I just published a descriptive analysis of a five-year experience of one of our difficult airway response team studies that we did. And then also a study on, student wellness, so medical student resident wellness, and that's going to be in Clinical Teacher. And so if you guys are interested in, you want to read some of my education or my clinical work, feel free for that as well. But this evidence-based medicine is sort of a passion and a side hobby. I'm in no way an evidence-based medicine scholar, but this is something I think everybody should incorporate into their practice.
You make it sound easy.
I know. I was going to say, like, how many things that are on the side are we doing? Like, how many sides? Is it like a Rubik's Cube? Is it like an octagon? You know, like, it's many sides. I feel like we need to have you back on, Nick, for like just going through ACT, like the fifth step, because I feel like there's so much there that really kind of is really rich material. But on to the next time. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank
this is amazing.
Thank you so much. This is great.
Yeah, thank you.
That was such a great episode with Dr. Nick Maldonado. I feel like I learned so much. One of the things I appreciated the most was just how he broke it down into such basic steps. And I think for me personally, my thought of evidence-based medicine was that I needed to understand statistics and, you know, be able to like run a journal club in 4 minutes at the bedside, which I really appreciate that he took it quite a few steps back and gave us a clear framework to like just start with asking a question, making sure the learners can ask a question, and just start with sharing resources, because I think those are really valuable skills. And then I also like the framing of thinking about it in a broader sense of, you know, how does this apply to the patient and how do we talk through it with the patient and allow the shared decision making.
I agree, Molly. I feel like I am just going to be blown away by the term federated searches, like our search database. Like that was a new term for me. And I need to look up the TRIP database and do some digging, because if it's really organized in the five S's that like it shares kind of where things fall, I'm really excited to honestly just take a tour of that database with whoever I'm teaching, you know, even like the students in clinic tomorrow. I feel like this is something that's really applicable. What about you, Charlotte?
I can attest to that. After I first heard Nick talk a few weeks ago, I was like, how had no one told me about the TRIP database? It's free. I think the biggest takeaway is teaching students how to think critically. And this seems so doable. When I hear evidence-based medicine, I usually kind of shudder internally. But I think asking questions is going to be my place, starting place, and kind of go from there.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders series, The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for helping make this season possible. And thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to our team at PodPace for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoyblein.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review our show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. And I've been Dr. Ira Krzyzanowska.
Finally, I've been Charlotte Jaquin. And a reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at thecurbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment.
Yeah.
Yum.